Ali Smith is no stranger to the Man Booker Prize. Autumn is the fourth of her novels to be shortlisted. It's set during autumn 2016, shortly after the EU referendum. Daniel is 101 years old and reflecting on his past. Elizabeth, born in 1984, has a wary eye on her future in a Britain that seems more divided than ever before. So, Ali Smith, welcome to Read On Air.
Thank you, Red. I'm so glad to be here.
Autumn, obviously, is very much the season of great changes, and central to the book Autumn is the post-Brexit feeling in the UK. Did you feel compelled to write the book?
I've been thinking about writing these books. There are going to be four books, all named just simply after the seasons, and I now know for sure I've been thinking about them for about 20 years. But I always thought I would do them when I was really, really old, which of course means I'm probably really old now. I don't know how these things come on us. Anyway, the reason I went with it is because I had discovered in the novel before writing this one that publishers could produce a book in its finished form very, very fast, and that the long time you usually have to wait for a manuscript to turn into a book isn't necessary. So I said to my publishers, well, that's really exciting. That's like when the Victorian novelists wrote their novels. They wrote them on the hop, as it were. They wrote them, you know, kind of racing ahead of themselves. They published them as they wrote them. How about if we tried to write something that was really contemporary, published it right up against the time about which it is, the time about which it's written, and is that possible? And they said, OK, we'll give it a go. So I started writing it, and then the Brexit process, as it were, started to happen, and then I realised that maybe books are more mysterious than we think, and that they, you know, they have their own demands on us that we don't know they're going to make until we actually start writing them. So I went with it, and I wrote the time as the time was happening. And that's how this book has come about. And the other three coming after it will also be, to some extent, contemporary in the same vein, with any luck. And, of course, the thing about the novel, as a form anyway, is that it's really about time and how time passes. And the thing about the seasons is that they remind us that time isn't just one day to the next, it's cyclic. It goes around in big circles inside us. So we remember all the autumns when we encounter in autumn. So it was an interesting experience to know that we were right up against the glass ceiling of Brexit, and everything was about to shatter into what? Who knows? And at the same time, you've got this sense of dimension about the dimension of time, the longness, the profundity of time, the depth of time, as well as the surface on which we all live.
And certainly that was a touchstone I kept coming back to in some of the darker moments of the novel, and there are some very dark reflections on the division that has been caused by Brexit. There are lots of metaphors of division and lots of images of division within the book, and yet there's also a lot of humour, and a lot of that humour plays with the fact that this is a cyclical process, that the world will not end just because of the Brexit vote. I found myself laughing and gasping at the same time.
That's lovely. I like that description of the book. I like it because it has hope at its core, as time does, because time does pass. And it, with any luck, it's also uncompromising enough to be truthful to the very difficult things that Brexit hasn't just caused, but has revealed in the country. The divides, the divisions, not just in this country, but the divides and divisions that we now know are worldwide, you know, and that have been there for all the years and not been attended to. And so Brexit, in a way, is just, it's like the revelation of it. The book I began to write before we were sure the Brexit process was happening was already full of questions about the mass movement of people across the world, how we relive, you know, how we live in a world which is shifting so fundamentally, and how we do this in a humane way it was always, I think, at the basis of this novel, this story. But really, really, at the basis of it is dialogue, talking to people that you don't know. And, you know, the life that comes from dialogue, from talking to someone else, from multilogue, from the conversations that form us as people and that teach us as people and that allow us to know how alive we are.
And actually, in the book, you do use the expression "the end of dialogue," and then in the next sentence, talk about democracy having become like a broken bottle that you can threaten somebody with. I wondered, in amongst the lists that you have there, the Google search type of language that that bubbles up through some of the narrative, if you feel that people have got too much choice, they're endlessly looking for an answer, and so they go for a knee-jerk response and become absolutist one way or the other.
Oh, I think we're living in times that are asking us to be binary, that ask us to tick a box to suggest who we are, you know, to hold up a passport, and this is supposed to mean us. This little piece of, you know, this little set of pieces of paper in a little cover means us. We are human. We are multivalent. We are layered. We are fascinating. We are not what we see on a screen or what we live with on a surface. We are dimensional, and I think that the use of language generally reminds us to be dimensional wherever we encounter it, in whatever form, because it asks us to think about meaning. So we just have to look twice or three times or whatever it is that language is doing, and we know where we are with what language is asking of us, or what the uses of language are that are being foisted upon us or offered to us. And that's why, in a way, the literary project is so important, because the novel as a form has always been about newness and about how we live and society, all those things, and about time and about the time in which we live. So if we look to the novel, we'll remind ourselves of our own dimension.
And you do something very novel with this book that I hadn't come across before. The third character in the book is Pauline Boaty, who's a real-life character who was the female pop artist, the only female pop artist in the UK in the 1960s. And you describe beautifully her art, for which I'm very grateful. I can't see it, and to have it described for me is wonderful. But actually, I suddenly realised that your book is also a collage, a montage of what you've seen around you, of your reflection of the debate over Brexit and how people are approaching it. And I suddenly saw it as a picture rather than the book.
Oh, that's a lovely, I love you talking about my book. Please always be the person who talks about my book on the air.
You carry on writing them.
because Pauline Boaty, as you say, a real life person who died very young. She died at the age of 28 in the mid-60s, 1966. She was not only the pretty much one and only female pop artist that we have had in this country. She was also a kind of beautiful force of energy and of dynamism and of excitement and of articulacy. Really early on in the changes that were coming through the 60s, Boaty was one of the speakers and the visions of what was possible for us all, but particularly for women at this point in juncture. And one of the things she did was respond with all her thought, heart and spirit to the contemporary. And so her work is full of contemporary reference and collage, which holds together Missiles and Kennedy and Elvis and Marilyn and the Beatles and Fellini and the things which were happening all around her at the time that were becoming famous because of the way in which the images of them were being proliferated. And what Boaty does, it's so brilliantly simple. She addresses the image, she repaints, reimagines the image that we think we've seen a million times, or we've heard about and we think we understand and we know. She reimagined it and she re-presented it. Now, one of the joys of what you've just said to me about the workings of this book is that actually none of us can see any of Boaty's work, because none of it's publicly available to see at all. So the descriptions of them, the notion that that's a gift of Boaty to out into the world is just, I think, that's a lovely thing. It's kind of filled my heart with, yeah, that was good, that was right. To me, it's a crime that we don't have her work available. Her work exists in private collections, and there's one that exists at the Tate, which has now been, it was out for a while at Liverpool and has just been put back into storage. And it is the most spine-tinglingly beautiful thing to see and to be near or to have described to you. And I wish it was more available. But here we go. That's good. There's a payoff to this book, which is that we're making those pictures available in all the ways.
And you are bringing to people's attention that it is perfectly possible to hold oppositional images, thoughts in balance with each other and judge them objectively in a world of rather subjective judgment that we live at the moment.
In being battered as we are with information, it is possible to stop and take stock. It's as simple as that. And it really is simple, and it really does need us to draw up a moment and just think, OK, now I know that's possible to do that. And with any luck, that this book also signals that that action.
Well, no, I certainly you've introduced me to a figure who I hope to hear an awful lot more about. Mm-hmm. And let's hope, well, if there is an exhibition of her work, would you come round and be my audio descriptor, please?
Oh, I so would do that. I would do it with joy. I would love to do that.
In the meantime, obviously, many of your books have been made into talking books and are available from the Talking Books Library. Mm. You've been quite instrumental in making sure that's happened and been to the studio before to hear them being recorded. Mm. Is it something that's close to your heart?
It is close to my heart. I am a fan of all the ways that there are to read in the world. And there are many, many ways to read in the world. And Talking Books is one of the most exciting ways to read because it goes direct to voice. And there's nothing more important in any story than voice. So the notion that a voice can simply be there in your ear telling you the story as it happens is to me a form of magic. And I love it. My own eyes are getting worse and worse as I get older. I'm also really keen on large print books. And I also have a family member who has lost his sight. He lost his sight as a child. And so I know very familiarly how important the Talking Books project is.
An absolute lifeline to anybody who's lost their sight and wishes to carry on reading. Mm. And one of the wonderful things about the Booker Prize is that all the shortlisted entries are made available in giant print, braille and audiobook, which is another reason why we have as many of your books. I believe this is the fourth of your novels that's been shortlisted for the Booker.
It still feels like the first. So it's funny to be treated as the old experienced person on the, you know, in the process when actually I feel just as naive as ever, you know.
So the excitement is still the same.
It's just kind of mind-blowingly exciting, and at the same time I have to ignore the excitement because, hey, I know what it comes to. you just carry on with your work, you know, the thing happens and then you carry on with your work, and the thing happens, you carry on with your work. So it's lovely to know it's coming. It's always a pleasure. I'm in a really privileged position to be able to even say that, but I'm also looking forward to it being all over.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed that it'll be fourth time lucky. Ali Smith, thank you so much for joining me on Read On Air.
Thank you, Red. That was a total delight.